Russell, Andrew, welcome back to the Android Central podcast. How you guys doing?
Good. It's been a good one.
Doing fine.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear it. It is. We're going to get through a lot today because it's been one hell of a week in the Android world. We have OnePlus 6. We have HTC U12 Plus. We have the Moto G6, which we should have talked about a long time ago, but there's just so much to get through. And then we have this whole stuff with Essential because apparently it's no longer. And we got Kitu. We got some Amazon derps. So let's get started. But first, I just want to say happy GDRP day. GDPR day. Jesus.
What's happy about it?
Nothing, except that you can't access Tronc publications if you're in Europe anymore, which I find absolutely hilarious.
That's probably all right.
It's true. Nobody cares. Well, actually, they actually have some very good publications. But if you're not paying attention, if you haven't been actively ignoring, I don't know how you do that.
If you haven't checked your email this week.
Or the last 3 months, you may not have seen the countless privacy policy updates. That is because of the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation that went into effect Friday, today, May 25th, 2018, that basically doesn't allow companies to pummel you with email unless you consent to it. It also improves the transparency of the way that companies store your data. There's a whole bunch of stuff out there on the internet that I think you should read because it's kind of a good thing for consumers. It's something that we deserve. It's just a shame that it took the European Union to enact it as a regulation to get all of these U.S. tech companies to actually do anything about it.
And to be clear, since this has happened, I have gotten 146 emails telling me that I'm going to get fewer emails.
Because what they're doing is they're basically doing what smart, sensible companies already did, which was a double opt-in system when you sign up or somebody else signs you up for an email newsletter or, you know, some kind of mailing list where instead of just entering your email into a box, you enter your email into a box, then they have to send you an email, and then you have to opt in a second time from that email. So it means that only you can authorize being signed up for an email letter, a newsletter or list or anything like that. It just shows that some 99% of the companies that you deal with weren't doing double opt-in in the first place. And so they have to send you this thing now.
My favorite is USA Today. So the company has a second Europe optimized or GDPR compliant version of the USA Today homepage, which is ad free. It's free of trackers. It's clean. It has no autoplay video. Like the way that you think the internet should be is the way that the internet is being presented to Europeans, and the way that we have it is the way that the internet is being presented by advertisers.
Those are going to converge back together a bit as, you know, USA Today or any other publication figures out how to add back in those things within the framework of GDPR. So
right.
It's going to be like this amazing thing for a little bit because they're worried. And so they were like, okay, we're just going to take everything out because we don't know what is and isn't compliant. And then they'll work and they'll make sure that they build out the things. And I think the way that we're seeing it is interesting because we're not in Europe and yet we still get much of the knock-on effects because these are big companies that operate globally.
Russell, one of my favorites is from a Xiaomi-owned brand called Yeelight, which shut off access to its cloud-connected lights because of this GDPR non-compliance. The whole platform, the way that you remotely activate multiple lights, is just no longer available because apparently they were sharing so much information with third parties that they didn't get a chance to send updates to the lights in time for GDPR.
You can't really do anything there but laugh. Like
it was highlighted by the most appropriate of Twitter accounts, the internet of shit.
Of course.
And it's, if you're not following that account, you should. But all of these examples are showcased at a really simple site called the GDPR Hall of Shame, gdprhallofshame.com. It's run by our friend Owen Williams at O, who has a really great newsletter called Charged, which I think you should sign up for. It's fantastic. It's, I think, a daily newsletter, just kind of going over the latest in tech. And yeah, he's done a great job bringing all of these terrible GDPR examples in one place. So let's start. Let's talk OnePlus 6. Andrew, the embargo lifted Monday at midnight, and you were on a beach, I think, in Mexico.
Not at midnight, but I was just briefly before that.
So you got to witness the chaos from the comfort of your you know, beach house. Mm-hmm. But you have the phone, and you've been using it since the day I have. And I'd love to hear what you think about it, because I love it, except for a couple of nagging issues that just kind of come with the territory with OnePlus.
Mm-hmm.
But what say you?
Well, I read, of course, all of our coverage. I spent a lot of time, you know, reading everybody's coverage, and there were a lot of common themes. And that's always a pretty good sign. It means that the company, you know, got the basics right. It got a lot of things right. And the complaints that people have are all very similar. And I think I agree with them. I'm not a fan of the haptics still. I was thinking about this again last night, where I was doing what I shouldn't be doing, which is staring at my phone late at night. And every time I press anything in the interface that buzzes, you can hear the vibration motor. And, you know, that's one of those just things that, like you said, comes with the territory of a less expensive phone. I'm also not, after spending an entire week in very sunny conditions with absolutely no clouds for an entire week, the screen just still isn't completely up to speed with like a Galaxy S9, for example, in terms of daylight visibility. We could talk about the notch later, I suppose. And the fact that it's, yes, I know it's supposed to be water resistant of some sort, splash proof, whatever. But I just, again, spent an entire week by a lot of water, and I was worried about it because it's technically not rated IP67 like other phones. And, you know, those are basically my only three complaints. Everything else is fantastic about this phone, and I'd happily use it every single day.
Yeah, I mean, just because it's a less expensive phone doesn't mean it has to have bad haptics. I'm using a Moto G6 that mm-hmm. has better haptics than the twice as expensive OnePlus 6, but that is just something OnePlus has never really thought about. And to be fair, most Android manufacturers haven't thought about haptics at all. I mean, until the LG V30, that just wasn't a thing, right, in the Android world. And then people are like, oh, right, you should care about haptics because they really do enhance your experience. But at the same time, there's something, it's not just that it's bad, it's that it's incredibly overpowered. Every single yeah. time you touch the screen, every tap of the keyboard, it's completely disproportionate to the feeling of using a touch screen.
And I keep going in, like I keep checking the vibration settings to make sure that I have everything set on the absolute lowest, and it's always set on the lowest. It doesn't matter. It's like that.
Yeah, there's no granularity.
Floor is super high,
right? And that's something that I appreciate about. I mean, I received the Honor 10 last week as well, which is a similarly priced phone. It's not available in the US, but it's about 400 euros, so it's a little bit cheaper than the OnePlus 6, but in the same ballpark. For performance and specs, and it has a haptic motor, a vibration motor that's more powerful at its maximum than the OnePlus 6 is, and it's it's set to that by default. So the first time I typed, I was like, oh my God, this is horrible. But you can tone it down. You can go into the settings, you can set it to one or two, and you can do the same with Gboard or any of the keyboards that you're using. And it becomes much more subtle, much less offensive. And my issue is, for some reason, I don't know if it's a hardware decision or if it's something that they just didn't think about in software, OnePlus has no option to tone it down at all. So it's at one setting. It's like your foot's on the gas, you know, you're up to six on the on your gauge, and you just maintain it that entire time, right? And there's no subtlety there. It doesn't quite ruin the experience for me, but if I'm looking at two phones sitting next to each other and I'm making the decision to use one, I'm always going to go now to the one with better haptics.
How much of that do you think is because the phone is entirely glass? Because, like, we've had phones that have had really intense haptics before, like the HTC One line. The original HTC One had ridiculous vibration controls. But because the phone was metal, I feel like it absorbed a lot of it in ways that this phone just can't.
That's a really interesting point. I don't know. The only thing I would say to that is the OnePlus 3, 3T, 5, and 5T have the same issue. So I don't know if it's a matter... I'd have to compare them side by side, which I haven't done. But... And this is a little bit in the weeds, because every time I bring this up to somebody who doesn't care about haptics, they make fun of me as somebody who... I mean, if you've used an iPhone since the iPhone 6S, you know that the Taptic Engine is a great addition. It's a reason to use an iPhone. But if you're not used to it, if you don't have experience with great haptics, you may not care, and that's fine. That's whatever it is, you know, whatever gets you up in the morning. But I really do think that it improves your experience. And I've been using the G7 the last couple of days, and it's also got the same high quality haptics as the V30. Elsewhere though, Andrew, the camera, because this is probably the biggest improvement to the phone.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the discussion around the camera, and I wrote something ahead of the launch, it was like, I'm not going to give this any benefit of the doubt, because OnePlus has said that the last few cameras were good too, and they were not. And especially with another price bump, it has to be good. And whether it's the new ISP and the Snapdragon 845 or mostly the new sensor, it's right up there. I would say in daylight, it's at the point where, like most phones from the last year or so, they're all pretty damn good in daylight. And in like mixed lighting, it's just about there. And the only time that you can tell that it's not, you know, absolutely top class is when it's really dark, you know, completely dark street scenes or, you know, something like that, where, you know, it's really tough to do those things. And it takes a lot of advanced tuning. And you can tell where, like, the Galaxy S9 or the Pixel 2, you know, they've specifically learned how to do those super dark shots, compared to the OnePlus 6. Has the camera experience has always felt a little more, I don't know, would you say by the book or kind of just normal? It doesn't do a lot of fancy processing as much as it just relies on the fundamentals. It just happens to be that now that it has OIS and a much larger sensor, that the fundamentals are just raised considerably from the 5T.
Yeah, physics helps. You know, there's not a whole lot you can complain about when they increase the sensor by 19%. And the 845, I mean, I said this last week before we were really allowed to talk about camera quality, but I said, you know, the 845 has improved every single sensor or every single camera experience to date, right? I have no doubt that if you took any phone and you had the exact same specs, except you swapped out the 835 for the 845, you would just get a cleaner photo. And what's funny is that I was, you know, Google Photos sends you notifications. Hey, you know, on May 25th, 2015, 2016, here are some photos. So I was looking at my photos from May 2016, and I was using the Galaxy S7 at the time. And it's amazing to look at the difference in low light compared to what we have today, because I didn't think that we'd come as far as we have, but the amount of grain and digital artifacting in low light photos in phones just 2 years ago was much, much higher, and it was extremely distracting. Whereas the OnePlus 6, in my experience, regularly takes photos in low light with ISO 6400, right? That's on a regular camera, like an SLR even, you would see a lot of grain, you would see a lot of artifacting. And that's because there's no digital post-processing from a photo like that. You don't have the same post-processing until you get it into Lightroom and then you do it yourself. Whereas on the OnePlus 6, you can use that photo out of the box, so to speak, right? It doesn't require much in ways of editing, because the whole system just works to denoise it, to make it look a little bit smoother. But on phones like the OnePlus 5, 5T, you would get a lot of splotching because that post-processing would just eat into all of the detail.
Yeah.
With the 6, I don't see that. I just see a pretty clean, decent quality low light photo that doesn't blow any other phones out the water. It's not the Pixel 2. It's certainly not the Mate or the P20 Pro, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm just scrolling through a bunch of my photos I took kind of late at night in the center of this city we were staying in, Mazatlan, where obviously there's not a lot of light pollution or anything. It's lots of small buildings and all that. And even some of the darkest photos I'm looking at are ISO 800, ISO 1000, you know, because there is light available. It's not like a completely dark street or anything like that. And they're clear. They don't have all of that blotchiness that you were talking about. And I think that that's just the biggest difference. They still have some issues with white balancing and some of the colors aren't perfect, but those things are more subtle than, you know, your eye can immediately perceive if you look at a photo and it's kind of all watercolory and, you know, has all this noise. Those are the things that, you know, hurt your eyes from, you know, from a first glance. You can get over the fact that it may not have perfect colors or, you know, things like that. You notice those more in side-by-side comparisons, but you would always notice the noise before. And the funniest thing is that this is all happening with this main camera sensor, because OnePlus did another flip-flop with the second sensor.
It's so, so annoying.
Tell us how you really feel.
It just doesn't make sense.
Why? It doesn't make sense that the second sensor is there to my...
It might as well, not be. I don't even understand it. So
this is a 20-megapixel sensor whose job it is make portrait mode shots, right?
And that's it.
Does it do that?
Yeah, I mean, portrait mode is fine. It's not bad. But I don't think it's... So here's the thing, right? Some of the marketing that I've heard about this phone says that the second sensor also helps with low light, right? Like the 5T, and that they're not marketing it like very aggressively because they don't want people to get the wrong impression about the main sensor. But I have not seen anything to that effect, sort of officially.
Like, neither have I.
I've heard kind of through the grapevine and a little bit off the record that the second sensor is still being used to enhance low light photography, but you'll not see that on their site. You won't see that advertised the way that it did on the OnePlus 5T.
Because that was such a bad idea before.
Bad idea.
Again, would you just talk about the physics of it? Why would you ever switch to this second sensor that has smaller pixels than use the main one that's also supported by OIS? It makes no sense to use the other one, because that, unlike the 5 and 5T, the main sensor here is very capable in those situations. So you really don't want it you know, or even need it to hand off anywhere, because as we were just discussing, it does a good job on its own. I don't know. It's very curious. And I've taken some good portrait mode photos, but it's just so, again, you have those things that immediately catch your eye when you look at the sharp edge of something that you took a portrait mode shot of, and it's kind of blurry. Your eyes immediately notice that, because those are just things that you naturally perceive without even thinking about. Whereas, you know, you can already get good background blur out of an f1.7 lens that you have on the main camera.
Yeah, I also see that as being an issue. That the benefits of a fake portrait mode are not good enough to, or let me put it another way, the natural bokeh you get from a decently framed photo using the main sensor is probably better and more naturalistic than what you would get with a portrait mode photo, because OnePlus isn't quite there yet. I mean, to be fair, Samsung isn't quite there yet. Nobody is there yet except for Google. So, and maybe Apple, because it's been doing this longer. But I really don't think that OnePlus is quite there yet. Russell, how many portrait photos do you take now? Like, I don't really take that many.
I take a bunch with my kids because they really like them. And I don't take, I have used it more frequently than I thought I was going to, but I definitely don't use it unless I'm thinking about it. Like, if I just want to take a quick picture of something, then I don't bother. But if it's something that, if it's something that I know I want like a really good picture of, I will frequently go to that mode.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And OnePlus does make it really easy to go back and forth. A quick thing though, OnePlus also added 4K video at 60 frames per second, which is awesome. And in the slow-mo mode, there's 1080p at 240 and 720p at 480 frames per second, which isn't as fast as that of the Galaxy S9 or Sony Xperia XZ2, but this can go for a full minute capturing slow-mo as opposed to 0.3 seconds at 960 on those other phones.
We talked about this with the Galaxy S9. I think we were talking with Jerry, and I was saying I would love to see a 480 mode, because Galaxy S9 would do 240 and then 960. And 960 has a lot of limitations with the amount of light that you need and the fact that it's really hard to time that shot. And because, you know, what it records for 0.4 seconds or something like that, you know, just to absolutely nail that motion, even with the automatic mode, it's so much better to just be able to shoot a bunch of 480 and then you can just crop out the portion that you want. And you don't have all of these limitations. I like 480 more than 960 just for that reason.
100%. And the fact that you can go for a minute means that you can just keep shooting. Like, you don't have to worry about getting the perfect movement. And I don't know, the whole 0.3 second limitation kind of negates any benefit of those really high speed slow-mo modes.
I think the only reason I disagree with that is Samsung's auto capture mode is really good. It's really hard to use the 960 on the Sony phone because it doesn't have that auto capture, and timing that shot is really difficult. But the one thing that Samsung has going for it, I agree that a 480 mode would be good, but the 960 set to that auto capture, the software detection for it is just phenomenal.
It is, but the light needed, or the amount of light needed to get it usable at all is pretty high. Like, you can't use slow-mo indoors
found at all. No, it has to be broad daylight.
So overall, I think this is a big upgrade. I think OnePlus has done a lot to justify the $30 price increase. I like the new colors. I like the addition of a 256 gig storage model. Especially since it's only $100 more than the baseline one, it's still well under any Sony or Samsung LG flagship. So I think this gets a win, and I just hope that OnePlus sells a boatload of them, so it'll continue making great phones. And yeah. it stops, you know, doing stupid things from a customer service perspective, because that's the other. And I you know, we used to harp on OnePlus for updates, slow updates, that it didn't get new versions of Android quickly enough. We can't really say that anymore. Now it's just, how's the customer support? How's the warranty? Is there, do you feel comfortable buying from a company that had its payment processing hacked only 6 months ago? You know, these are all the other things that we still have to think about when it comes to OnePlus.
Yeah, but I agree. That's always an issue, and it's something that we're not always thinking about when we look at the reviews and we say, oh, you know, talk about the phone itself. That's something that just more seeps into the consciousness over time. And, you know, it may not be a lot of lost sales now, but it could be. I mean, if you were somebody that was affected by one of these things directly, you're probably not even looking at the OnePlus 6 at all in the first place.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay, so I do want to talk a little bit about the other OnePlus product that was announced last week. And we didn't talk about it much in last week's episode, only because we hadn't really used it. And that's the Bullets wireless headphones. So, Andrew, have you had any time to use these yet?
Actually, today was going to be the start of it, because I'm just finished writing my long-term review of the Pixel Buds. So oh, this God. Was going to be it. Yeah, I'm the guy using Pixel Buds still, actually.
You know, I've never gotten to even hold one of those, and I still really want to touch them, even though you and Daniel regularly crap on them.
I do, and yet I continue to use them, because this is a Bluetooth life we're living in, and I need those things.
So but. What interests you about them, Russell? Because I don't know. I don't understand the attraction.
Well, for me, it's the real-time translation. I have a really, really unique use case in my house. I have two kids, one who is learning French full-time and one who is learning Chinese full-time. And when they get mad at each other, they shout at each other in their respective languages. And I don't speak either of those languages. So it makes being a parent difficult.
Oh, man, that's so cool and yet so frustrating.
Yeah.
So I would very much like to know. I don't think it works that well from what I've heard.
No, I hope that the way that it works in my mind is that I will have my phone and press like the capture button to record audio while they are shouting at one another, and it will pick a language and translate it into my ear. It probably will not be able to do both at the same time. But if it can do that, then it's kind of worth it to me anyway.
So the Bullets wireless have no such feature. They don't pretend to be smart. They just work as wireless earbuds. They're $70, and I've been using them pretty much full time. Like, they've been on my neck.
They're neck buds. Almost, that's important.
They're neck buds, but they're not the same as, say, like an LG Tone, which is a true neck bud in the sense that it has a plastic piece that,
yeah,
that you then pull on to extract the earbuds themselves. This is sort of a hybrid.
This reminds me more of the Samsung level ones are more similar to this in that it's a smaller, lighter, more flexible part for your neck, and there's no retractable anything. It's just more of a way to hold batteries down there so yeah. that they're not pulling on your ears.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So far, these are fantastic, and I'll tell you why I prefer them to pretty much every other neck bud earbud that I've used. First, the auto connect and auto disconnect feature just works. The two earbuds are magnetic and they connect back to back. Once they connect, it disconnects from the phone that you're using. And once you open them again, as long as you're using a OnePlus 6, it reconnects automatically.
That's so smart.
It tends to reconnect to my other phones too, but not consistently enough that I would say that it's a feature that I would, you know, that I would tout. So occasionally I may have to go back and kind of manually reconnect it. But once that's happened, I put them in my ears and they're super comfortable and they sound great for the price. A couple of things. The fast charging with USB-C is outstanding, like 10 minutes, and I get a full day of use out of them.
That's great.
USB-C itself just means that I can bring these with me and don't have to bring a micro USB cable, which is one less micro USB cable in my life. And there's just the, I don't know, they just work. They're super comfortable.
So the interesting thing about these is, like I said, I want to compare and contrast them to the Pixel Buds because these are only $70, right?
Yeah.
And the Pixel Buds are $160.
Yeah.
And they're arguably different products considering that these are much larger, and the Pixel Buds, you know, for as big as the case is, they actually are small, a small device, and it wraps up tightly. How are you finding that you can, like, what, how do you store the bullets wireless when you're not using them? Because they do have this neck part, even though it's flexible, it's not as easy as wrapping up a pair of wired earbuds or sticking like AirPods or Pixel Buds in a case.
I guess so. I don't really think about it because they've just been so active. Like, I use them every time I leave the house to take my dog for a walk, and they stay by my front door. I slip them on my neck when I leave, and I'm you know, good to go. So the use case for me isn't maybe as, like, I'm going to bring them with me to New York when I'm there next week. We'll see. I don't think I have an issue with storage, but they do come with this little silicone pouch that's kind of neat. And it looks dumb, but it's magnetic. It has a magnetic enclosure. And overall, I'm happy with them. I went for a couple runs with them and they didn't fall out. It took me a while to get the right combination of tip size and wings. Comes with these like wing tips that help them stay in your ear. I determined that my ears are mutant ears and they don't actually work with wing tips. So I had to find the right way to put them in my ear without wingtips, with, you know, whatever. You'll find a way. Where there's a will, there's a way. So yeah, I'm happy about it. I just find it kind of funny that OnePlus announced a pair of wireless earbuds the day that they announced a phone that also has a headphone jack.
Mm-hmm.
And then touted the fact that they have a headphone jack in the phone.
It's a phone that doesn't come with headphones in the box. So, you know,
right.
And they do make pretty good, cheap wired earbuds too that are, what, $15 or $19 or something like that, and are a good cheap pair of earbuds. But it's nice to see the kind of OnePlus philosophy of very simple, well-made accessories coming across to having a pair of wireless earbuds that anybody, you know, could enjoy, whether using a OnePlus phone or not, is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I think the weirdest thing about this is that every time I see pictures of these headphones, they look very, very similar to Vmoto's Forza Metallo wireless headphones.
Yeah.
Only those headphones suck in just about every possible way. They are by far the most disappointing set of wireless headphones that I have used this year. And it kills me that all of the little mistakes that Vmoto made, when I look at all of the stuff that I've seen from these headphones, it's just amazing that, like, it's like the whole list that I had of things that I didn't like about those Vmoto headphones have been checked off in these Bullets wireless headphones.
Yeah, I actually wanted to, because I like the Vmoto Crossfade Wireless 2 headphones, and I've been using those for about a year now. So I wanted to try the Forza Metallo wireless, but every review I read touted the same problem, that there's way too much excess cord when you put the earbuds in your ear. There's just like this long cord that flaps around and has nowhere to go. And to me, that just seems like a terrible design.
Well, and the earbud things don't clip together either. Like, there's
that's true.
There's really just nothing to do. And the design of the extra cord is actually really distracting around my jawline. If I go to run, like, there's just enough that it just hangs down and smacks me in the, like, the bottom of the face. it's just really just unpleasant the entire time that I had them on.
So I'll say this about the OnePlus, Bullets Wireless. They've copied the Beats X design enough that none of those problems are there. Like, these are not unique, these are not unique headphones in any way, but they just stole from the right companies. And that's fine in my books because they charge via USB-C, not Lightning, and they are cheap. They're $70. So yeah, that is a winner in my eyes. I'm going to be really interested to hear what you think about them, Andrew, because you and I feel like have a similar taste in headphones, and I haven't heard of anybody disliking them. Even Vlad Savov, who's at The Verge, who's like the most notorious hater of all things cheap headphones, loves them. So I don't know if I should feel validated when I read his review, because his esoterica is like has its own esoterica.
But yeah, you never know. He might actually be disagreeing with you, but it just seems like he's agreeing with you.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he's writing in like Chaucerian English or real English. But anyway, I love you, Vlad. But you know, he knows his writing is obtuse. I'm excited to hear what you think about them. Before we move on, is there anything else you guys want to talk about with the OnePlus 6?
Do we need to address the notch again? Because I'm so tired of it, but you know, no. It's a thing that people talk about.
It's not an issue. Like, get over it. It's done. It's not even a problem. So if you think the notch is the biggest issue in your phone, then you don't want to buy a phone because it has a notch.
Then you're not listening to the haptics, right?
Yeah, that's fair. All right. So we're going to take our first quick break and we're going to thank our friends at Thrifter. Thrifter is the place to go for all of the best deals right now. If you're interested in smarting your home, you can get some Philips Hue light bulbs at a significant discount. That's one of many things that Thrifter has on its homepage. And as we do every week, we go to the Thrifter homepage and we pick a deal that we like. And I'll let you start, Russell, because I see one that I think you're going to pick.
Yeah, I figured that you had already nailed this one down. IOTTIE, spelled IOTTIE, actually makes a bike and motorcycle mount that I own. I actually use this this bike mount, and I paid way more for it than is available on Thrifter right now. It is normally $20 now, which I think I actually paid $35 for it when I got it, but Amazon has it on sale right now for $15. This bike mount would like it just keeps whatever phone you put in it just so completely stuck in place. It's not even funny. It's actually kind of obnoxious to get a phone out of it, but that's a good thing because you know that no matter what you're riding around in on your bike, you're not going to have to worry about your phone falling off and shattering when you're going 20 miles an hour. So yeah, it's a solid overall mount, and you are not going to find a better deal than $15.
That is I'm so impressed. You said that you biked 40 miles this past weekend.
Yeah, I connected two trails in my area. It was fun.
I'm so proud of you, dude. Honestly, like seriously, amazing stuff. I don't think I could ever do that. So if you want to be like Russell Hawley, get the IOTTIE bike mount. Andrew, what's your pick?
I actually also picked an IOTTIE thing, but it's the car mount that they make. They have it down to $20 here. I know that this specific deal looks like it's expired on Amazon. I don't care if it's full price or you wait for another deal to come because I think it's on sale like every other week. They have a OneTouch 3, OneTouch 4, whatever version. This is the mount that I use in my car because, you know, we're switching phones all the time, and this thing can clamp onto the biggest phone in a case or a little tiny phone. It's all adjustable. And it's adjustable in and out and up and down, and you can mount it a whole bunch of different ways. So you don't have to have like a specific type of dashboard or a specific, you know, windshield angle or whatever to have it work. If you fiddle around with it enough, you'll get it to telescope in and out and move, you know, exactly where you need it. And it's cheap. And just like, Russell was saying with the bike mount, you cannot get your phone out of there unless you know exactly what to do. And they call it a one touch because it has a little pad in the back that when you place the phone in it, it instantly clamps down around it when you put your phone in there. So all you have to do is sit in the car, stick the phone there, and then it's there. Turn on your car, Android Auto launches automatically. It's super clean.
I like iAudi products. This is turning into just like an iAudi shill, but they're not actually sponsoring this piece, I promise. I have an iAudi car mount as well, but my car is the last year of the Acura RDX that came with a CD player, and I haven't used a CD in my car in 10 years.
I don't have CDs.
So these CD mounts are actually great because they're so secure and they don't cover up any of the other controls on the dash, which I love. So because the way that my car is designed, there's no way I can use a suction, and I don't really want to mess with the windshield suction because in the summer they always end up coming off and you end up with like a sticky iAudi on the floor of your car, sticky Audi. So yeah, this just defeats that. But I don't know. I mean, they've kind of become the go-to brand for car accessories, I feel, or car mounts.
And,
it's interesting.
And they're not expensive, which is the funniest thing about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just work. I'm going to go off and do something a little bit different. So Andrew, I know you love the Peak Design Everyday Backpack. I just got mine. And I love it too. It's a great bag, but it is expensive. It's $250. If you don't want to spend that much money on a bag, the brand Timbuktu is, in my opinion, my favorite for a more budget-focused backpack. And right now, Amazon's selling. They're selling the Timbuktu Division Pack, which is kind of a simple laptop bag if you're, you know, back to school, university, whatever. This isn't a fancy bag by any means, but it's big. It's made of really good quality 400D nylon. It fits a 15-inch laptop. It's really comfortable. It's got one. My biggest issue with the Peak Design, and I think yours as well, are the quality of the straps. They're not really padded. They don't support your back well enough. Timbuktu makes that a priority. And every Timbuktu bag I own, and I've owned them for years, they have fantastic quality straps. So you can wear these for hours and not get back pain. The Division Pack is down from $110 to $76. And it's going to be all through. By the time you get this podcast, even if it's like next week, it should still be $76. So I highly recommend looking at it.
They have a really good warranty on their stuff too. If you ever notice any like separation around the zippers or anything like that, any stitching coming undone, you can mail it in or take it in and they'll just swap it out. They're really good about that. But the funny thing is that I've had my two Timbuktu bags for years and I've never had anything go wrong with them. You just know, you know, that it's available.
Yeah. My Timbuktu bags end up being my travel bags. Like I have a huge 40-liter bag that I bring with me to conferences and stuff like I.O. And then I have a 20-liter that I just use to pad around the city. And I think I've had both of those upwards of, one I've had for 11 years now and the other I've had for maybe 7. And they look brand new. So highly recommend Timbuktu stuff. All right, that's a long segment, but... You know, and I, you know, just to kind of like go, you know, broach the fourth wall for a minute. We have heard a couple people complaining that these thrifter segments are a little bit long and convoluted. We're going to work on adding chapter markers in these podcasts so that if you don't want to listen to this, you don't have to. It's coming, and I really do appreciate your patience. If you do have any feedback about the ad reads as well, let us know, podcast@androidcentral.com. We're always interested in hearing what you have to say. And if these don't appeal to you, if you just want us to go, hey, Thrifter, thanks for all you do and move on, let us know. I mean, we may not do anything, but we do want to hear what you have to say. So really do appreciate the feedback and keep it coming. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Essential Phone. So, or Essential, the company. Andrew, you pilloried the Essential Phone when you reviewed it, and you pilloried it again when you re-reviewed it. And we just heard yesterday that the Essential Phone 2 has kind of been, well, it's been canceled. But the company...
Unofficially.
Has the entire company been canceled? Or
so that's the thing we don't know yet. Andrew Rubin said that the Essential Phone 2, he didn't actually name it, but he said that we sometimes cancel products so that we can prioritize more important ones that are going to be big hits. He also did not state it, but there was, I believe, an internal email that got intercepted by a journalist that said that the company's trying to raise money and that the rumors of it trying to be sold were wrong and that it's actually damaging because it may hurt the potential for raising further funds. But regardless, the Essential Phone 2 is not going to come out. Is that a big loss to the market, Andrew? Do you think OnePlus could have done it better for the sequel? Sorry, Essential could have done better for the sequel?
I thought I was having a stroke there for a second, but I'm all good now. But it's interesting in the light of the OnePlus 6 coming out to hear this, because the Essential did not do the basics right at all. It was a cool looking phone, and they had a lot of interesting stuff with the very tiny bezels and the little notch at the top. It was very clever. The titanium and ceramic thing was very neat, and nothing else about the phone was good. I don't care how many software updates it got. It was bad from the start, and it only got a little less bad over the last 10 months. It was just not a good product. And we're in a world where we nitpick over little things like, haptic motors, which, by the way, the Essential Phone had like the worst haptic motor since 2008. But we nitpick over those little things because every one of these phones, anything over $250, does all of these basic things well. And the Essential Phone couldn't even get the absolute basics right. And on top of the fact that there were never any accessories, all of their modular ideas, except for the 360 camera, never came out. All of their link up with their supposed home stuff never happened. It just wasn't looking good from about 3 weeks into the launch until now. Nothing really played out the way that anyone would have expected, given the initial hype. And from that perspective, I don't see how Essential could really go through with just launching another phone unless they were going to completely re-architect everything and do something entirely new, because it building on this platform with the way that company launched a phone was never going to work again. They would have to completely change the way that everything works anyway. So this is just not surprising to me in the least.
The narrative, Russell, around the Essential Phone when it first came out was, here's Android's founder, creator, auteur. Andy Rubin is given a pass because he's Andy Rubin, because he's this... I don't want to liken him to Steve Jobs, but there's a sort of Steve Jobsian aura around the guy in a way. And this seems like, it seems like maybe the phone wasn't really the point, right? The Essential Phone was meant to bring the company lots of press because it's an obvious thing to make. But I don't know if it was ever the priority, right? It never seemed that way, at least.
Well, I mean, there's two schools of thought there. It was something that we talked about really, really early on. Jerry had a couple of comments on this, was that, Andy Rubin is kind of a serial entrepreneur. He likes to come up with ideas and he likes to share those ideas with other companies. And he was very, very successful in coming up with Android in at such an early stage that Google decided to buy it and just invest a ton of resources into it so that it became the thing that it is today. But he's also always been kind of the idea guy, not so much the execution guy. You look at Danger Labs for the Sidekick phones. Those were also fairly successful, but they had a lot of kind of nerdy problems that never really caught on to be particularly popular outside of T-Mobile users. And so this is, he can come up with a lot of cool ideas, but not a lot of them really pan out. You take a look at the other things that Essential promised. along with the Essential Phone were the smart home things that never really came together. And I think we're probably a bigger part of the strategy was having this kind of unified set of things that you know appealed to all of these companies working on smart assistant things, because we're all in the middle of this kind of smart assistant rush right now. And so having a foot in that race is probably a good idea from the perspective of someone like Andy Rubin, who can come up with kind of flashy things. But on the other hand, you know, the phone itself, you know, had its own set of kind of neat ideas that just never really got polished to the point of being executable. And so there's no saying that their home product wouldn't suffer from the same problems.
Yeah, I mean, and we saw that to some extent with the first and only mod that was a release for the Essential Phone, the 360 camera. The execution, the idea was great. The execution wasn't. I mean, using magnets is not a new thing, but it's a much simpler application than, say, the Moto Z series with their Moto mods. The company just either didn't have the finances, didn't have the number of engineers, or just didn't have they didn't have that next level to be able to execute properly.
It takes a ton of expertise, and all of these companies that are making phones right now, even a younger company like a OnePlus, leans heavily on Oppo. Or you have, you know, even Huawei that really got into the high-end phone business only recently, had years and years and years of being able to make all these components and thousands of people to be able to work on these things. The deck was stacked against Essential with a small team, even with hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, to be able to come up with something right out of the gate that was good all the way across the board. And it had to be really good. It was launching, if they had launched the Essential Phone in, you know, maybe not that exact product, but, you know, this group launching this kind of thought into a phone in 2012 or 2013, it would have been a lot different of a discussion, because phones just were not up to that high level, you know, across the board as they were launching into mid to late 2017, where it's like, yeah, you were launching at $700 against a Galaxy S8. It's just like, yeah, good luck. It's just not, you're going up at a completely different scale, and it doesn't matter how much money you have at that point. You can never buy the amount of expertise and, you know, time of launching multiple phones over a period of years to figure it out.
I also think it's worth pointing out that a lot of companies, and they used to do this in secret, but now they are doing it more publicly, because I think the relationship is more understandable. But a lot of companies lean heavily on Qualcomm to improve their Android experience. You know, the Qualcomm in recent years has try to push this narrative that it's not just an SoC maker. It doesn't just make the Snapdragon CPU GPU combo in your phone, but that it's sort of a full solution company for Android manufacturers. It will help them not just take their chips, but implement them, optimize their camera, help them with AI, make the UI smoother. And you see this when, like, for example, the Xiaomi Android P beta, the Android P beta for the Xiaomi Mi Mix 2S that you guys saw in California, that actually had a bunch of Qualcomm applications on it, because they use them as testing apps for upcoming software releases. So it's interesting that I wonder how much involvement Essential had with Qualcomm when it was building the Essential Phone, and if that was an issue with optimizing the hardware for the software.
I I never thought about that. I know it's very clear that there's not a lot of optimization done on that phone in any respect, but you wonder how much really just comes down to the base hardware, or I guess the base firmware of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it's speculative for sure, but I do know that increasingly Qualcomm is touting its relationships with companies like OnePlus, like LG, and you see these press releases being issued. You see Qualcomm executives on stage at various launch events, and I can't. And also, we've talked to Qualcomm executives about this, and they want the perception to be that they are more involved in the conception and development and execution of Android phones than we give them credit for. I mean, look at the press release that was issued just 2 days ago about the Snapdragon 710. This is basically a Snapdragon 845 that's been truncated. It has the same cryo cores, but they're slightly slower. It's running basically the same X16 baseband, but it's an X15, so it's slightly slower. It doesn't have support for as much. It's basically like Intel when they build, you know, their high-end chips and then just like artificially chop off some of the speed and shut off some of the cores and then sell it at a cheaper price. But Qualcomm is heavily involved in the manufacture in the development of a lot of Android phones today. And I wonder how much involvement they had with the Essential phone, if at all. Anyway, this is something that will be interesting to watch over the next few months, if only because we haven't heard anything from Essential in the last few months, like nothing. So they may as well have shut down already.
And I think that I'm not here to, you know, dance on their grave or anything, because it hasn't been dug yet, or at least hasn't been filled. But I don't want to overstate the importance of Essential. They released one bad product, didn't release anything else that they promised, and then we haven't heard from them about, you know, any future products. There's so much going on from other companies that are actually making good things that that deserve our time.
Yeah, like Red.
And Segas.
Oh, man, that's cruel. Are you putting Segas and Red in the same category?
Until Red's phones come out,
yeah.
So Red held a sort of secret hands-on press/fan thing this week in Los Angeles. We weren't there, but Dieter Bohn from The Verge got a chance to go and look at it. He saw the phone as it is in prototype form, but he wasn't allowed to show the front of the phone because apparently the screen, the 4D hologram, blah, blah, blah technology is not ready to be shown on camera yet. Russell, I mean, this is a $1,200 phone. Why is this happening?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, people use their phones as their primary camera for everything, and Red is a company, for people who don't know, just the Lord High Commander of making absolutely insanely good cameras. Their video cameras are more than just professional grade. They are just insanely high quality. I have seen people take Red Epic cameras or Red Dragon cameras and take pictures at night, just in total darkness, and be able to use the data in that photo to edit it in such a way that the photo, when it's done being edited, looks as though it is completely daylight. In those environments, it's just these cameras capture an enormous amount of data and allow people to manipulate those images in just really powerful ways. They are crazy good cameras, And Red thinks that there is a market for bringing some form of that experience to the phone in your pocket. And if they can deliver that, it's going to be awesome, you know, because even if they're able to get just a fraction of what a proper Red camera can do, then there will be a market of people who will spend any amount of money on that experience. You know, even just amateur filmmakers, you know, who have, you know, $1,500 and will spend that money instead of, you know, the $3,000 a day that you will spend renting a proper Red camera. So, you know, that in and of itself is enough to get a certain small but, you know, spendy group of people excited. And they're also tacking a bunch of really cool stuff onto this. The promises of this holographic display may not turn out to be anywhere near as exciting as they promised, but one of the big things is being able to experience depth through this single panel in the way that you normally would need like a VR headset or something for. So they have partnered up with a VR 180 camera manufacturer to you know, produce video for this camera at launch in such a way that when you go to watch the video on this screen, you get the auto stereoscopic depth effect that you normally require a headset for. Not terribly dissimilar from what you get in the 3D mode on like a Nintendo 3DS, but instead of like the weird awkward slider on the Nintendo 3DS, it's just a mode that will exist on this screen.
And this is less about people, random, normal smartphone customers buying a Red Hydrogen 1 than it is about Red camera users, the ones that operate, you know, that do commercial filming with Red cameras, the option of using the Red Hydrogen 1 as a viewfinder and augmenting the filming process with the smartphone. There's a mod that should allow for Canon, Nikon, Fuji, and Olympus lenses to be affixed directly to the camera. Yeah. So if that works, then that opens up a whole world of like customization and the kind of cameras, the kind of photos that people just would never be able to capture using smartphone lenses and sensors.
And to be clear, this is not a pull the phone out of my pocket and take a quick picture. This is pull the phone out of my pocket, reach into the camera case that I have brought with me, and pull out the very expensive lens that I have brought with me and affix it to this case. And that's still going to be less work on behalf of these people than it would be to carry around even just the cheap Red cameras, like the Red Raven camera kit. They're $15,000 kits that, you know, that have a very simple lens attached to them, and you're going to spend another $2,000 at least on other lenses that you're going to buy for this camera. So this is, you know, this is not for someone who is quibbling about the price of the Pixel 2. They're not going to be interested in this phone.
So it was announced in August of last year, and it's probably not coming out until September of this year, August or September. But the interesting thing is that both Verizon and AT&T have committed to selling it. Despite its $1,200 MSRP, there will be a $1,500 titanium version, which is crazy. And what is it? Amortized over 2 years. It's going to be like $50 a month. It's not cheap.
And aren't those the early prices, or are those the prices that are set?
Oh, I don't know.
I thought that they had said that those are initial prices, but
yeah, I think those are initial prices. And we will probably see other versions that get announced later where, you know, there are versions, there are kits that are sold with, you know, a whole bunch of accessories that Red has authorized to go with this that will make it, you know, an even more expensive bundle. But, you know, This is not a mass market phone, and the Red will never say that it is.
Hmm. And the design of the thing is very clearly pointing to that. It's a massive phone, thick and heavy and huge, and has these big rubber grips along the side. It really looks like the rest of the Red camera gear, and it looks like an industrial piece of professional equipment. You know, like one of these cat phones or something like that, not like, you know, a OnePlus 6 or a Galaxy S9 Plus. It's not sleek and trim and ergonomic and light.
So another phone that is maybe slightly less niche, but not that much less, is the upcoming BlackBerry Key 2. We now know that this is the name of the phone because BlackBerry Mobile itself released a teaser video this week showing off the keyboard, the screen, and is just getting in front of this June 7th announcement. It's got a dual camera setup, which was shown in the teaser as well, and this interesting looking key on the right side of the bottom row of the keyboard. It's got 9 dots. It's not clear what that button does, but it's been highlighted in the video. So, you know, we kind of knew this was coming. The Key 1 was a slow burner, if you will. It hasn't sold in the millions, but I think it sold far more units than anybody gave it credit for when it was announced at CES 2017. Wow, it's been a while. So, yeah, like Russell, as somebody who really truly loves keyboards on his phones, what's interesting about this to you?
I dig just the size. Like it looks like a phone that's gonna fit pretty comfortably in my hand and give me access to all of the keyboard things that they've been working on. This is going to be a solid alternative to the phones that we have right now, because I have to be perfectly honest, I've been paying really close attention over the last couple months. I hate all of my virtual keyboards. Doesn't really matter what phone I pick up. I don't like any of them anymore. I've become less happy with the Gboard. It makes way more mistakes than it used to. At least it feels like it does. So this honestly might be, you know, I might just as a palate cleanser go back to the Key 2 just to kind of reset myself and just ditch virtual keyboards altogether for a while. I do hope. I don't know if this is going to end up being the case, but I do hope that the button on the side, this weird secret button that they're hyping up, I kind of hope it's like an alert slider kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Like, I think that would be really cool.
I mean, just like based on what we know from previous BlackBerry phones in general, I mean, dating back to like the BlackBerry OS days, they've used these convenience keys / like shortcut keys for a long time. So my guess is that it's something to do with that, where you'll press it and it'll like load one of your favorite apps, or, you know, allow you to do a whole bunch, like maybe an overlay, which gives you like a shortcut list or something.
How crazy would it be if they went full nostalgia and it was a walkie-talkie button?
Ooh, yeah. No, you know what I think they should do is just that button loads an emulated version of BlackBerry OS that you can use in a window. And then you can just pretend that you're in 2009 and things are simpler. So I like that idea.
Maybe you push the button and it makes the camera good.
Oh, shade. You're right, though. I mean, the Key 1 promised a lot and didn't really deliver with the camera.
They show dual cameras on the back here.
Yeah.
Can't say the BlackBerry team is like super excited about selfies, so maybe it is something else.
At the same time, who knows? Like the keyboard is the thing that sells the phone, right? Nobody else, like a camera on a phone like this is not going to be a big seller. In many cases,
it has to just be good enough.
Yeah, right? In many cases, it's just going to be like disabled from the enterprise side. Like it may not even be a consideration for many of the users. But yeah, we'll see. So I'm kind of looking forward to it. I'll be in New York. I believe, Andrew, you'll be in New York as well for the launch.
I have flights.
I'm going to go.
Oh, so all three of us are going to be there. It'll be like a Google I.O. reunion. A little AC meetup.
I don't know what I'm going to do there yet, but
me neither. Who knows?
We'll get better pizza than we did when we were in California.
Yeah, fair.
We should do an entire podcast about pizza.
We should just do a pizza podcast. I've said this many times. We should have a food cast on the AC channel. Every few weeks, we should just dedicate an entire episode to food. I think
you need to leave
fun.
A comment, seriously, if that's something you want to hear, because I'll do it. So pay attention, listeners, if you want a food cast, not like every week, but maybe like once a month, because I'd be down.
Well, as we consider that, as you guys write your emails, we're going to take our second break and thank our sponsor, GameStash, for their support of the show. GameStash is an app that you install on your Android phone, and it gives you access to hundreds of games for a single monthly fee. For $5, you get access to games all the way from action games, platformers, classic games like Badland, to an increasingly awesome collection of kids' games. If you are a parent and you need that third parent in your life just to take a break, you throw your phone in your kid's lap and you just say, watch YouTube. This is an alternative. GameStash has a collection of kids' games that will make your mouth water. And for $5 a month, that is, it's so helpful. Honestly, I've heard from parents who use GameStash. Their kids love the selection there. And if you head to GameStash.com/ACPod, you can see all of the games that are available both for you and your very, very annoying children. Actually, they're not annoying. I'm sure they're lovely, but I'm sure they're also very annoying at times. So go to GameStash.com, sign up for a 30-day free trial. There's no commitment. You can cancel at any time during the trial and you won't pay a penny. Head to GameStash.com/ACPod and sign up right now, and we thank them for their sponsorship. All right, Andrew, let's talk HTC U12 Plus. This was announced this week. It was kind of it didn't come out of nowhere, I think, but it certainly wasn't something that was on my radar. Maybe that's just because HTC itself isn't really on anybody's radar these days. But it's a big phone. It's got a lot of the same qualities, the same design language as previous HTC products. It's beautiful and it's kind of weird. So walk us through this.
And it's kind of expensive too, but we'll probably get to that at the very end. The funniest thing about it is that it's the U12 Plus. There's no regular U12, just the Plus, because they wanted to denote that this is the bigger, taller version of a standard phone, just like the U11 Plus was. And I think it was kind of off our radar. Well, I guess the U11 was kind of off our radar too. But when you look at this one, it's a lot of the same, especially compared to the U11 Plus, which is just a handful of months old. They just went to dual cameras. They kept that shiny, glossy glass back. They added a transparent E version from the start, which is cool. And they went to dual front cameras and then just kind of made some spec bumps. And the one standout feature is this very weird thing where the buttons are not actually buttons. So the volume button and power button, volume buttons, they're just there for show. And it uses sensors and haptics to give you feedback and tell when you're pressing them.
So there's like a notch there, like you can see the notch in the pictures, but there's no physical mechanism underneath. Like if you push, that key doesn't actually travel up and down.
No, it's like the MacBook trackpads from the last couple of years.
Man, yeah, that's weird.
Like an electromagnetic motor underneath it that makes it seem like it activates every time you press it. But when the screen is off, when the phone is off, they do nothing.
And it uses that. It has further EdgeSense capabilities to kind of know where your hands are on the phone all the time. So, for example, if you're holding the phone as if it were in portrait, you know, kind of with your fingers, tips of your fingers on one side and your thumb along the other, auto-rotate won't happen if it happens to move, because it knows that you hold the phone differently in portrait to landscape. Huh. Smart things like that. But there's this other downside of, well, you know, buttons are nice too, you know, sometimes.
Maybe. I mean, I guess it depends on how well the software works, but like as an idea, that's kind of neat.
It is very neat. And obviously, Edge Sense is one of the few things that HTC does. Obviously, it's in the Pixels as well. Most people just got reminded that their Pixels have an Edge Sense squeeze
right.
Technology. But it's one of the few things that they did differently. They said that, you know, it's just a way for them to differentiate, but also it helped them, you know, more easily be able to be waterproof because there are fewer points of ingress because they're just dots there. There's also still no headphone jack, of course. I'm struggling to find out why I would get excited about this, other than the fact that I remember that I really enjoyed using the U11. It was just kind of also steamrolled by all of the other phones out there. This one, at least, I never used the U11 Plus, so maybe that's why I'm a little, you know, have a little bit of excitement for it. But it's not doing anything particularly special for me. If the buttons don't work out, that's going to be a real problem. HTC's software is just identical to what it was before. The translucent one looks cool.
It does, because it's also blue now.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that. And
the U11's camera was really good. It did not get the credit that it deserved for being a really fantastic camera. And so if there's any improvement there, that's great.
Yeah, it doesn't... I mean, HTC's products haven't received the praise that they've deserved for a few years now. The U11 was a very solid product, as was the U11 Plus, even though it didn't come to the US. The camera on the U11, I think, was close to the Pixel in terms of quality. It did an astounding job in both daylight and low light. It just didn't have any of those extra features. It only had a single sensor, so it didn't offer portrait mode. It didn't have a telephoto lens or anything like that. It was just a solid shooter. And it fell back on a lot of the features that have been there, like HTC Zoe, since 2012. And I think that's one of the criticisms that deserves to be leveled at HTC, is that they're not innovating on a software perspective at all. Like they make solid hardware, but their software hasn't improved in 5 years, 6 years.
Right. And you compare that to OnePlus, which has really fantastic software, a couple quirks, you know, like every other phone has. But I think unless you've been using HTC phones for the last 5 years straight, you would prefer to be using OnePlus's software.
I would, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even when the U11 was updated to Oreo, which it received way before any of the other the 2017 flagships, it still felt like the same software as a few years earlier, which isn't inherently bad. I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I don't know, there's just I get a feeling when I use an HTC product that I'm using something that's like out of date from a software perspective.
So let's talk about the price, huh?
Yeah, so $800 US, unlocked, and it's not coming to any carriers.
Well,
yeah, that's basically the only response you can make is, okay, sure. Good luck with that.
The interesting, Hayato, who wrote up our preview of it, wrote in the headline how it's beautiful, but it's unattainable. And of course, part of that is not that big of a deal when we just got done talking about the OnePlus 6. Not only is it sold unlocked, it's only sold directly from OnePlus. You don't even have a choice of retailers. But it's a little bit different. OnePlus has a group of people buying its phones. That's just how they buy phones, and they're all in on that. And it's a dramatically cheaper price, $250, $300 less. That's a different story from if you're HTC, you're trying to go after that more general consumer, somebody that would buy an LG G7 or a Galaxy S9. Or an iPhone 8 or something like that, but you're not in the carrier's stores at all. You don't even have like just Sprint or something like that. And the price is a lot higher. That's really tough. I mean, so the U11 was $699, right? But it was, you know, pretty much $50 off all the time. So $649 was really competitive for the U11, and it kind of aligned with the fact that, yeah, it was still a 16x9 phone. It didn't do too many fancy things, but it was, you know, a solid step down. This is $800. It's almost the same price as a Galaxy S9 Plus.
I think we should give some credit to HTC where it's due. The phone works with Verizon, which the OnePlus 6 does not. So that's a big deal. The second thing is that it offers financing on its US site, which OnePlus doesn't either. So you can finance this over 2 years the way that you would at your own carrier. It's $34 a month, 0% APR, which is a pretty compelling offer if you're approved, if you have good credit. There's also a trade-up program on the company's website, plus the fact that you get the HTC insurance thing. I don't think it's called uh-oh anymore, but it's like the first time that you crack the screen, it's included in your deductible or whatever it is. It's a much more compelling warranty program than the OnePlus warranty program, which basically doesn't exist. So it also comes with headphones in the box. It's IP68 water and dust resistant. It's just a much more fully featured product than the OnePlus 6.
Yeah, absolutely.
But is it $250 more than the OnePlus 6? Is it worth $250 more? That's up to you.
Yeah, I'm just more speaking to the goal of what HTC is trying to achieve right now. Needs in the US needs carrier support. Not just from a sales perspective, because you're right. If you want to finance the phone, that's available everywhere. It's more so that people will never even know to go to htc.com and buy the thing because they will never hear about it. Unless they're in the know and really getting kind of into the weeds about a high-end expensive Android phone, they're not going to know about it. One of the best ways for people to find out in the US is having a deal with a carrier. The carrier markets it, the carrier puts it in the stores, you know, the ball kind of gets rolling a little bit. Look, we were just talking about the different ways on the site that people can buy a Galaxy S9 unlocked and why you'd want to do so, and the fact that you can still get financing and all this, and like, hey, maybe you should buy it from Samsung.com. That's a different situation from HTC that is just trying to get customers of any kind. I do commend them for selling it directly unlocked. I think that that's kind of, you know, that's the way that I would buy the phone if I were to buy it. But for the general populace and actually getting people buying HTC phones, they need to have those other avenues.
I also think it's just a very different community of people, right? Like the OnePlus was from the very beginning, from the teaser campaign of the OnePlus One in 2014 all the way to today, they have built a culture around buying the phone online. They've built a community of people that support one another, that hype up the product. Everything about it is OnePlus.com. Whereas HTC came from the carrier circuit and it's slowly been ghosted. It's just been like every carrier has just stopped supporting the phone. There is no mention of HTC's flagships on any of the carrier sites anymore. And it's like, this is the last resort. HTC has no other avenues to sell its phones other than HTC.com and Amazon. And because that brand is no longer associated with the US market, it never built up that reputation of being a, you know, an e-commerce company. So I think that's where the disconnect is.
Yeah, it started out as that general appeal, mass market, you know, competitor to LG and Samsung, and never really made that transition. And now it's killing it, in, you know, in a bad way, not in a hip young.
it's you're actually killing it. Way. Killing it.
Killing it's dying. It. Not killing it. But from the phone itself standpoint, I'm excited to have one. I should have one here in a little bit. I want to use it. I use the U11 for a long time. I want it to be good, and I hope that it is. Whether or not it's going to make any splash is pretty much undeniable. It's just not going to. But yeah, if the product's good, we'll recommend it.
Well, yeah, I think that's all we have to say about the U12 Plus. I mean, it is interesting that there's no U12, but I guess it makes sense from a branding perspective.
Yeah.
Russell, what do you think?
It's so weird. I have nothing else to add. You guys covered everything pretty clearly there. I don't want HTC to go away.
They're not. I mean, you, like, from your perspective, like, HTC is becoming basically a VR company, right? And what I find so interesting is that the demos of the U12 Plus included an AR demo, I believe, where the U12 was being used as a viewfinder for the. I should find it before I actually talk, but I saw this somewhere where the U12 Plus was used as a viewfinder for VR, so that it was like mirroring what people were seeing in VR.
I wonder if it's something that attaches to like the Vive Focus.
Yeah, I think like these are the things that HTC has to hype up. You know, it's not necessarily going to be exclusive to a U12 Plus. But it's something that HTC can say, hey, we have this platform, this ecosystem that includes our phones and our VR and our AR aspirations. We're not just a phone company anymore. It's just one thing that we do. And it's kind of the way that LG is taking it, except LG makes stoves and fridges instead of VR equipment. But the G7, when we were in Korea, they were all about, hey, the G7 is just, it's one aspect of our entire business. And it complements the other things that we sell. And I think the U12 is being positioned more as a complement to a lot of what HTC is doing now in VR. Which to me makes sense because nobody's buying this damn phone.
Ouch.
And I think we'll leave it there for today, because I think we just reached an hour and a half, and you know, people have places to do and things to be. So, and I'm sure if you're listening to this during the Memorial Day long weekend, I hope you're drinking a beer and eating a really good hot dog because you've earned it.
Not a carrot dog.
Damn it!
What is a carrot dog?
It's the New York Times, I think, had an article today that people are making carrot dogs as a replacement to hot dogs. And I'm telling you, if you show up at my house with carrots that have been put on a grill and then stuck inside of my a hot dog bun, I will not politely ask you to leave. I will just throw things at you.
Oh, it sounds horrible.
It didn't look appetizing either. It was this weird, and like they were dressed like hot dogs too. So like
yeah, they
ketchup
had, like,
mustard
on them.
But like these were carrots, like full-size carrots that had been grilled and then put inside hot dog buns.
Foodcast aside for a second, a carrot that's been grilled, great. A roasted carrot, lots of caramelization, lots of sweetness. You don't put condiments on it.
No, this was like relish and mustard and... Yeah, as soon as this is over, you're getting a link, and you're just going to sit in a corner and be sad, like I assume Andrew and I did earlier.
Like, you're just piling sugar on top of sugar. Like, the whole reason you get a hot dog is because you put the sugar on the savory. Come on, people. It's only, like, anyway, I'm glad that we ended this, because now I'm really hungry, and I'm just going to make myself a hot dog. A real hot dog. Everybody,
there you go.
Russell, Andrew... Thank you so much for being here. If you're listening to this, have a great long weekend. Enjoy your weekend. Enjoy the weather. And we'll see you next week.
Peace.
Bye-bye.